Hi there. Thank you for joining us for the Page 2 podcast, presented by Chase Oaks Church, where we will go behind the headlines and beyond Sunday morning sermons to discuss in-depth issues of faith, culture, and life. We would love to interact with you and hear your feedback, and we'll share more about how you can do that at the end of this episode. But for now, let me just say thanks for joining us for another installment of the Page 2 podcast.
I've got so many friends that are same-sex attracted, and I think many of them grew up in the church, and I have a lot of conversations with them saying that, you know, they grew up knowing God as a loving God and as a merciful God, then I hear so many of their stories where they feel like they've been rejected by that God, or they've been rejected by the people who are claiming to represent that God. And they feel that translates into how they view God.
We began preparations for the Page 2 podcast and started making lists for the things that we wanted to talk about. We knew we wanted to talk about topics and cultural issues that are swirling around the Christian community. And one of the first things that made the board is an issue or a topic we're going to be talking about today, because we're going to be talking about a topic that elicits strong emotions and heated debate in our culture and particularly in the church, because we're going to talk about sexual identity, the LGBTQ community, and the church. And so if you're not familiar, that acronym that I just said, LGBTQ, stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning. Today, for the sake of time, we're really going to be focusing on the first two of those letters, lesbian and gay. We're going to talk about the homosexual community that is in our church and around our church. And there's a whole lot of things to talk about. You know, a recent survey that I saw asked young people outside the church what the most accurate identifier would be of contemporary Christianity. And 90% of them said that the most accurate identifier of Christianity is that it's anti-homosexual. 80% of young people within the church in that same survey agreed with them. And that is just astounding to me. Not so much that the church or the Christian community would make a stance about sexuality, but that would become the main identifier. And so we're going to wrestle with that a little bit today. And we're also going to wrestle with some of the unique stories and challenges with of those within the homosexual community that are Christ followers and are part of our church. And we're also going to wrestle too on how the church can do better as we move forward. And so there's a lot of things for us to talk about, and so we're going to dive in. So welcome to the Page 2 podcast. It's a deeper dive into issues of faith and life and culture. I'm Greg Holmes.
And I'm Eric Torrance. Greg, as you talked about in your opener, I'm excited to jump into this conversation. I think it's one that is important for us to have for many reasons. I mean, you know, you and I are both pastors that work for a larger church, and so we get asked all the time about our church's stance on marriage and our theological views on sexuality. And it's almost as if this particular topic has turned into a litmus test that people use on whether or not a church is right for them. It's also an issue that, you know, it's been in the news with recent Supreme Court decisions, and the evangelical church as a whole is starting to divide, it seems, based on where people come down on this topic. It's really become just a very hot button issue for us.
Yeah. And I think it's also a difficult topic to wrestle with well, because there's so many paths you can go down, and there's theological conversations and personal ones. And what does this scripture passage mean? And you can get lost in the weeds pretty quickly. And so this podcast will most likely be the first of a few that we do, not necessarily in this first season, but I think there are a lot of different avenues and things we need to talk about. But, you know, I think, you know, Eric, you and I have both recognized in some of our conversations how important it has been for you and I personally to have people that we are close to, right, who are part of the gay community, who are following Christ and really trying to follow God in a meaningful way, and how that has forced some things in your theology and in mine, not necessarily to change things, but certainly to wrestle with things that might be easy to sort of dismiss if it wasn't if we didn't have those personal relationships. You know, I think it's easy for churches sometimes to, when you jump straight to passages or straight to theology and then stay there, it's easy to treat an entire population of people like they're a category.
Yeah.
And sort of dismiss things or whatever. But having personal relationships, having people that we're close to, reminds us that all theology is personal. It's not just abstract things of people. I mean, these are real people, many of whom love God and want to follow Christ with all their life, and they're in our churches, and they're in our families, and they're in our neighborhoods, and so we need to wrestle with this in terms of real people. And so I think it's going to be great that we are starting this podcast by introducing our listeners to a friend of both you and me. Paul Martel has been a friend of ours for quite a few years. He's grown up in our church. He's been on staff at our church, and now runs a company that helps our church interact with people through our live stream of our services. And we are so grateful for Paul, and admire not only his knowledge and technical skills, but also over the last few years, you haven't been sort of real public with your sexuality, but you've certainly been willing within safe conversations to be open, to talk about that. And that has been super helpful for our staff and for me and for Eric and for others. And so I just want to introduce everyone to Paul. Paul, say hi.
Hey, Greg. Thanks so much for having me here.
Yeah.
Paul, it's good to have you. And I think as Greg was talking about it, that for both of us, you know, conversations change when we get to know somebody's story. I think it's interesting even, it's not like our theology should be based just merely around people that we've known in our life, but it is true that when people have family members or loved ones or friends that maybe express a different point of view or a different perspective, or in this case with sexuality, have a different orientation, that it should change the conversation. And so we're just grateful that you're here with us. As comfortable as you would be, I'd love it if you would just share some of your journey with us about what that was like for you in terms of figuring out just your journey in this area, because I know it's very personal, and yet I think that it's helpful for people to hear about, hey, when did you come to terms with your sexuality and what that looked like for you?
Well, me, like most sexual minorities, you know, gay or lesbian, mm-hmm. I realized that I had attraction differences really early in life, when I was really young. I mean, definitely noticed attraction differences around 11 or 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that's an age time frame that we don't even really understand our, you know, what sexuality is, or we're just maybe coming to get a small grasp of that. But, you know, we certainly don't understand what sexual orientation is. But we notice certainly what our friends and those around us are attracted to, or seeing their attractions and how ours are different. And so when I was growing up, I definitely started to notice those, and they immediately started causing questions of doubt about, is there something wrong with me, or is there something, what is this different thing about me? And I think so early on in life, that could also lead to feelings of almost shame and not being able to talk to someone, feeling a little isolated. Mm. And you know, I grew up in a community that was very loving. I grew up with friends and parents that were very present and very open and very loving. I grew up in a healthy church community too. But even though I didn't feel safe talking about those differences and those attractions that I was noticing. It just, from what I heard around from different conversations, it just sounded like that was something that wasn't okay. And it wasn't that they were talking bad about any particular person. It just that's what I was hearing. And so I didn't feel comfortable to talk about those and have questions. And so I kept those inside. And I didn't talk about them. I just kind of shoved them down and wrestled with those completely in isolation all by myself. And I think as I continued on through high school, those differences, those attractions never went away. They kept becoming even more present and stronger. And I didn't know what to do with those. I dated girls through high school, but the relationships really didn't last too long because I didn't have an interest, honestly, in dating. I was just trying to look at culture and what culture was telling me was right, what to do. And so as those relationships ended quickly, I just decided, well, I'm not going to date for a while. And so I did that, but those attractions were still there. And eventually I started exploring with the other side, those attractions that I really was feeling, just to embrace those things that I had been repressing for so long. And so I began exploring those relationships with someone of the same sex, and that continued through college. Mm-hmm. And I was welcomed into a really loving community of gay friends that made me feel like I didn't have anything to hide, that I could be myself. And I was really appreciative to have such loving people around me that I could be myself. And then, but throughout all of that, for me, my personal journey, I constantly had a conflict of whether this was right as far as a moral side of it. And I definitely didn't, I wrestled with that a whole lot. I didn't know where the balance is or where to draw the line. And I couldn't find, a moral authority. You know, I had so many voices telling me that I either could do whatever I wanted or, and then on the other side, I had this other baseline for a moral authority, and I didn't know where to choose. I didn't know what was right for me. But I did know that I always had this, this feeling that what I was doing, even though, it's what I felt was natural to me, I had this feeling that it wasn't right for me.
Yeah.
And I wrestled with that for many, many years. And eventually, I felt like I came to a point where I needed to choose between a life of sexual fulfillment, and or being present with what I felt God was calling me to do, and being in relationship with Him, which I just wasn't able to find a compatible match between those two things. And so, for me, I decided to step into celibacy, and it's been an interesting journey since then.
Yeah. So, thanks for sharing. You know, one of the common things that's out there in the public sphere when it comes to this issue is the topic of choice. You know, where you know, you'll hear it out there. I'm sure you've heard it, where it's like people in a sense would argue that you choose your orientation. And that's all that it revolves around. What would, from your very personal journey in this, how would you respond, or how do you respond to somebody that says that sexual orientation is a choice?
I think I really don't have to think about just my experience. I've heard from so many others that this attractions and they're not voluntary. These are not something that we're choosing. It's just something that's natural to us. Just like what I believe is a heterosexual person would find themselves attracted to the opposite sex. They didn't choose that. It's just that's the way it is. And that's exactly how I feel, and that's how a lot of my other friends feel. And you hear the nature versus nurture conversation all the time, and frankly, to me, it's probably a combination of both. You know, it certainly could be situations from the way you grew up or the interactions that you had, and there certainly could be a biological component. But really, neither of those you choose. They are just there, and they're just present. It's the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, Paul, and in previous conversations that we have had, I've heard you talk about how those attractions, and I think this is sometimes confusing for those of us who are heterosexual, that the attractions, it's not just about sex, that it's, you know, it's attraction to certain emotional connection, or it's a certain, you know, those types of things. Could you kind of explain that for us, or talk about that?
Yeah, I can try. Okay. That's kind of a difficult one.
Okay.
And it's something, honestly, the last couple of years that have been really, that's been more visible in my life.
Okay.
Whenever I decided for me to first step into celibacy, it was very heavy on the physical aspect, mm-hmm. side. You know, I have to, you know, I saw myself, you know, lusting and things that everybody, mm-hmm. deals with, no matter your sexual orientation. But the focus for me was on the physical aspect, the aesthetic aspect.
Right.
But recently, more and more, I see that I am also emotionally naturally drawn to people of the same sex. Mm-hmm. I desire deeper relationships with someone of the same sex, or I desire that connection and just the bonding experiences. It's just there's an emotional connection level there that is very strong, equally mm-hmm. as strong, in my opinion, as the physical and aesthetic attractions.
Yeah. You know, I know because I know your heart, you have been willing to have some of these conversations because of what you have seen within the church at large. And it sounds like you had a very loving family and a lot of support, which is something that not everybody has had. And so, you know, kind of from your perspective and from your history and what you've learned, and just kind of what are you seeing from your vantage point within the church and the LGBT community? You know, it's just kind of talk about that a little bit.
It's something that really breaks my heart when I look at what's happening and the way people's perceptions are. I've got so many friends that are same-sex attracted, and I think many of them grew up in the church, and I have a lot of conversations with them saying that, you know, they grew up knowing God as a loving God and as a merciful God, then I hear so many of their stories where they feel like they've been rejected by that God, or they've been rejected by the people who are claiming to represent that God. Mm. And they feel you know, that translates into how they view God. And it's just, it breaks my heart because I know that God loves them so much, but they have been so hurt. Mm-hmm. And they've become essentially, I don't know any other way to describe it, but hard to the concept of God's love. And it's almost like they can't see that or accept that or feel that because of how hurt they've been.
Right.
And therefore, they become almost uninterested.
Right.
You know, you used a phrase, sexual minority, which is a helpful one for me. And I don't know if you're how much statistics or how readily you have them, but I wonder, what are we talking about when we talk about minority, as far as in your experience or what you've heard or what you've read, like percentage wise, what percentage of the population are we talking about here?
Yeah, I think those numbers are sometimes really difficult to find, and you see kind of a wide variety of them, but I know of one poll from 2016 from a fairly large size of polling audience, and it said about 4.1% of American adults would identify as a sexual minority, and that means, you know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, questioning, and certainly those in the latter might be a little bit smaller percentages of that 4.1. But what's interesting also is that 7.3% of millennials would identify as this way. So there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, you could have people just being more comfortable, claiming that. It could be a number of reasons for that difference of change. But I think it does indicate or signal that, hey, more people are deciding to identify as that, we need to be even more aware than we were previously.
And that's a significant amount of people. I mean,
absolutely.
When we're talking about percentages there, that is not just a blip on the radar.
Right.
That is a chunk of people that are feeling, I mean, you talked about it, that if those are people at a formative age are feeling separated, feeling like there's a large part of their life that they aren't sharing with other people. I imagine that leads to a significant amount of shame and fear and guilt that translates itself out in different ways for the community. I guess, how have you seen that then translate to how the gay community has sort of formed an identity with each other around that? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that. Just yesterday I was talking with a friend who we have a lot of mutual friends from the group that we used to be in back in my college years. And most of my friends in my college years were gay friends. And what's one of the most interesting things that we've noticed on the social kind of scale is that the community is so tight between the gay community because there's this level of bonding that you don't get outside of it. You have these special characteristics that are uncommon and that you can bond around. You know, maybe they both suffer discrimination or they both feel isolated or they both feel different, but together you can bond over these differences. And it creates a very quick bond of relationships and connections, and it allows you to be a lot more go intimate quicker. And as far as, you know, what I mean by that is just have deeper conversations and things that you would otherwise, might take you a long time to share with someone who you don't feel comfortable with. So that's been super interesting. I mean, you can literally, I know a lot of my friends that they have friends in so many different cities because they can just fly around and then because if you're interested, if you're introduced by a friend who is from that community, they're so much quicker to bring you in and accept you and just be friends with you.
Yeah. You know, it's super interesting as you were talking about that, because I know even here at Chase Oaks, we have a community of folks here at our church, and you're part of that community that are in the LGBTQ community that are part of our church. And so there is something that kind of draws that community together, and I've had the privilege of sitting down with many of you guys, and there is some commonality, but it's not universal. Like, even within the church, there's some differences within the LGBTQ community. And so in just a moment, we are going to, I want to transition to talk about that. I want to talk about the experience, like personal experiences within the church, and have you kind of define some terms, affirming, non-affirming, what does that mean? And how do those within the LGBT community sort of live that out and that kind of stuff? And so in just a moment, we'll be back with that here on the Page 2 podcast.
Well, welcome back. Not all Christians think alike. It's why we have different churches and denominations. So I guess it shouldn't surprise us that not all same-sex attracted Christians think alike as well. But I know for me, I hadn't really given it the level of thought that I should about some of the different approaches that Christ followers who find themselves same-sex attracted kind of approach their faith with. And so, Paul, I'm really excited to have you here because I think you just explained it so well in some of the different things you're noticing with friends of yours or in the community of people that identify as both Christian and same-sex attracted. And so maybe could you give us just a cursory understanding of some of the debates that are happening within this community of believers about how they understand their sexuality and being faithful in following their faith?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say there's probably two high-level categories of Christians who are pursuing God and have to confront same-sex attractions. And on one side, you have those who would affirm sexual relations between two members of the same sex, and those are referred to as either affirming Christians or side A Christians. And then on the other side, you have the community that would say, I believe in a more traditional ethic of sexuality being between one man and one woman in the context of marriage. And those are referred to as non-affirming or side B Christians. And there's great books and great authors and historians, biblical scholars who have looked into both sides. And there are those on both sides of the conversation. And the arguments for or against are both very good arguments. They're not weak or watery arguments. And so you have this conversation going on saying, you know, what is it? What does the Bible actually say? What would Jesus do in these situations? And so those conversations still are happening.
Mm-hmm. So when you say, like, and I've heard you make this point before, that when, you know, someone refers to a gay Christian or a same-sex attracted Christian, that we in a sense can muddy the water a little bit, where we think someone is coming with a certain set of, you know, preconceptions of what they think or how they approach the Bible. And to hear you talk about it, it's to say, hey, there probably needs to be more clarity about what a person means or where they're coming from with that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we all know that you can make a whole lot of mistakes when you make assumptions. And I think in this, when it comes to this conversation, assumptions are a very bad thing to do. And I think it gets really muddy in our culture when we do have people who say, I'm a Christian, a gay Christian. That could mean that they are a gay Christian who is celibate, or that could mean that they are a gay Christian who thinks that it's perfectly fine to be in a relationship with someone of their same sex. So clarity in what they mean and just digging into that a little bit deeper is certainly nothing to be afraid of, and certainly even a better opportunity to get to know that person and to understand their perspectives a little bit deeper.
We've certainly seen that in a broader Christian community, like when the book Single Gay Christian came out, and there was kind of a hullabaloo a little bit just around that term, because there was some assumptions that was an oxymoron
around
term.
The term gay Christian.
Gay Christian,
yes,
you know, and so there's a lot of debate as to whether or not, like, that the term gay as opposed to same-sex attracted, that those fundamentally mean two different things. And that you can't, you know, it's like all of that kind of stuff. And it seems like some of those assumptions were happening by heterosexuals sort of making that decision for others. Do you have a leaning or a thought about any of that as far as the language?
Mm-hmm. Well, in all honesty, I'm still wrestling through that.
Okay.
I think up until about a couple weeks ago, even, I would be more on the, definitely on the side of, hey, let's not get caught up in this language and let it take away from the real conversations, the real points at hand. That would be my biggest thing, and I still totally am behind that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're causing somebody to stumble or get stuck on some language, like, that's just not where the conversation needs to be right now.
Mm-hmm.
I would lean more so on the side of there's a reason that people are still using those terms, and it's because they're expressing the way that they are in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody who is emotionally or physically attracted or sees the world differently, they're using that term to be able to describe that difference.
It's, right.
It doesn't have to necessarily mean that they're being sexually active or anything, in my opinion.
Right.
But it just is describing those differences that are not constrained to just erotic desires,
right,
that are much deeper than that.
Right. Right.
Yeah, it's almost like people are arguing about people's stories sometimes. That is a helpful thing to know about somebody, that when they say they're a same-sex attracted Christian, it's like there's a lot of things that help me know if I'm a single Christian, or, you know, there's a number of different categories that we use, and sometimes, I don't know, sometimes we get hung up on those labels, it seems like. If you don't mind me probing more personal in this, because, you know, when we just talked about affirming, and affirming is affirming side A, that's the affirming,
yes.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And then the non-affirming is side B. Where have you landed personally in your journey, and how did you come to that decision? I'm sure it wasn't easy with coming to that decision, but talk to us a little bit about that journey for you.
I feel You know, we talk about the concept of or the reality of the Holy Spirit, and I do feel in my journey that was a big part of my journey. I felt, and it's hard to describe certainly, yeah. but the speaking of the Holy Spirit, just saying, hey, when you're engaging in this same sex activity, like I'm not okay with that.
Yeah.
And that was my journey. That was my experience. And I think, but there's also a reason side. To that aspect where I have all these questions that I have to reconcile my sexual feelings with my faith and God's promises of flourishing and having a full life and all of these incredibly deep questions that a same-sex attracted person has to struggle and wrestle through when they're making those decisions as being compatible with their faith. And for me, whenever I made my decision to say, what I started with is just like, you know what? I'm going to just play it on the safe side for a while, and I'm going to stop all sexual activity until I can answer some of those questions myself. And what I decided to do was make a list of all of those questions that were extremely outstanding to me that I struggled with so much, and I decided to answer every single question on that list. And I think that was probably one of the biggest, most helpful things that I did in wrestling through that, because if we have these questions in our mind that that we don't have answers to, but we constantly face, it's just going to chip away at our faith constantly.
Yeah.
And as I worked through that list, that I was able to kind of draw a conclusion that seemed very clear to me, and that's kind of how my journey looked like on that path.
But then you would say too that you have friends that don't have that same clarity, or maybe have clarity around the other side of things. How have those conversations worked for you as you've interacted with friends that maybe think differently, friends that are in the same sex attracted community, LGBTQ community, that think differently than you? How have those conversations looked within the community?
Yeah, I really enjoy those conversations because, one, it's an opportunity to share and receive grace. So many people can expect you to become hostile or very confrontational in those conversations. And I have just absolutely loved the grace that God's given me to be able to have those conversations and, you know, not lose my temper, or just over the years learn how to navigate those better. And what's been so great about that is that they turn into really amazing conversations. I've got many dear friends who are definitely on the affirming side, the side A. And I love to probe into, hey, how do you come to that? Because, you know, I wrestle with this part, and what do you think about that? Those conversations are really great. And I always seek to respect that person and respect their opinions. But I'm also a person who really likes to get to the bottom of, you know, what is the difference between the way you think and the way I think, so
right.
that either it comes down to a belief, or it comes down to one of us is understanding something wrong. And if it's me, I want to understand it better. So that's why I love to probe into those and dive into those conversations. And they can really be great if you have that perspective.
Yeah.
So Paul, as a kind of a side B Christian, talk to us a little bit about, so what are the options then for you? For intimacy, or like what are the paths available for you?
Yeah. So for a non-affirming person, yeah. you basically have three options that I know of.
Yeah.
The first one is a potential for change in your sexual attractions. That is, looking back in history and time and talking with friends, you know, that just seems to be a really rare mm-hmm. occurrence. You know, where I'm not doubting that God can do it, or that He would want to do it, or anything about that. I don't see many examples
right.
of that happening. But that is one opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is mixed orientation marriage. So me as a same-sex attracted person, if I decided I wanted to pursue marriage in light of the way that I see marriage,
mm-hmm.
I would pursue somebody of the opposite sex, and mm-hmm. We'd have this relationship and conversation saying, hey, I'm same-sex attracted, but I believe that I can step into this marriage with you
right.
If you think that we can together work through the challenges of that.
Right.
Certainly there are going to be some unique challenges
mm-hmm.
In a marriage. And I would never want to step into that unless I've really thoroughly had that conversation mm-hmm. with someone I was looking to marry. And then the third...
Not something to wait until the honeymoon.
Absolutely not. No, no.
Right.
And you know, I could go, I would love, you know, at some point to go deeper into that conversation right. because I know a lot of people who they've grown up with these same-sex attractions and they didn't communicate those to their right. spouse. And now they're in a really difficult situation.
Right.
And you, when you look at mixed orientation marriages, you have a few success stories, but mm-hmm. you have a whole lot of failures.
Yeah.
And most of the failures have happened because there wasn't that communication up front.
Right.
And certainly, obviously, there are some that have failed because of the difficulties of mm-hmm. What that means.
Sure.
And the third option would be celibacy. Mm-hmm. And that would be, you know, lifelong commitment to abstain from sexual encounters and activity.
Right. Okay. I want to talk about that last one just a minute. Because, you know, as a church here at Chase Oaks, we would fall into that non-affirming camp. You know, we believe that God's we have much more of a traditional view of sexuality, and that we believe that God's best for human flourishing is sex within the context of marriage between one male and between a man and a woman. But we also believe that we are on we're all on a journey of transformation together, and like where else would we want people to be than here and learning together and those types of things. And I know that we have said that if you can't be married to someone of the opposite sex, then that means that God will, that you're called to a life of celibacy. I want you to sort of speak into a little bit, like I had a conversation with someone else who I'm close to, who's same sex attracted. And we had that conversation, and that person said, well, that's easy for you to say, you know, that, you know, and the argument that, I mean, not the argument, but the thing that I mentioned is like, well, there's a lot of people that aren't married, you know, like you can, like if you want to get married, but you just haven't fallen in love with someone or your spouse dies or whatever, that anyone that's not in a marriage is called a celibacy. And this person responded, it's like, but they have hope, you know, that they could mm-hmm. someday or whatever. Yeah. And that was a big difference. Like, speak into that a little bit. Like, if you make this choice to celibacy, what does that mean for you, mm-hmm. like emotionally and looking at your future and like all of those things?
Well, I'm surprised to hear that somebody else said that, because honestly, that's kind of a new concept to me, but it's so true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have all of these energies that are wrapped up in your sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And for a person who is single and has the looking ahead to marriage and to be looking ahead to have the opportunity to release those energies or mm-hmm. pour those energies into something, there's hope there. There is hope for the release of those energies.
Right.
But for a celibate person, that is not there. There is no hope of eventual relief from those sexual energies in that manner.
Yeah.
And so that's not an option for them. Mm-hmm. Placing those energies into hope and into pursuing relationships with the aim in those particular relationships of having that relief and that satisfaction, that's a nice place to put that.
Right.
At least, you know, you're not putting it back in your pocket and mm-hmm. gonna hold it there for forever. So it's really interesting to hear that came up again, and it's totally true in my life too.
Is that as you look ahead at a life, you know, and following this commitment, is that the biggest thing that you sort of worry about or whatever? Is is it the sexuality part, or is it just like the emotional connection and just kind of being alone,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, like what is the, how do you look at your future and, you know, that?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm tripping over my words.
No, so. I mean, it's something that words are going to be tripped over in these conversations, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But that question is a deep question. It's a hard question. And I think even looking back, whenever I was first considering making this decision, that was one of my concerns, the physical aspect, the relief, the sexual enjoyment. You know, that was one aspect that I was considering of not being able to have. But I think more importantly was the emotional side, and more specifically, the companionship side.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you are talking about marriage, there are so many beautiful and wonderful aspects of marriage that you're entitled to entering into that relationship in a covenant relationship. Mm-hmm. You're committing yourself to that other person. And you're doing that for life, and you mm-hmm. so you get that adventure, that life adventure mm-hmm. partner. You get those that person to anticipate your future with and to make plans with, and that not having that mm-hmm. is that's probably way more significant to me than
right.
not being able to have sex. I mean,
right.
don't get me wrong, like I want both, right?
Right. Right.
But I think I'm more fearful of not having that companionship.
Yeah.
I think it just changes this debate and this time. That's what I'm so grateful for your friendship and your openness about it, because when we've talked, it helps me put myself in shoes that are not necessarily mine or wouldn't be a part of my journey normally, but to sit and to think about, because to Greg's point, like I've had friends, I've had significant portions of my life where I've been single, and yet I've never not had that hope that wouldn't maybe not be the case in a year, a couple of months or whatever. And so to sit at this space and to wrestle with what that feeling feels like to make that decision and why that might be such a barrier for so many of our friends and family that are LGBTQ as they hear a message preached from somebody up front, which is from a good place, but it's like, wow, there is so much more to that than we often think about. And so I think for us, it's clear that maybe sometimes the church, and when I say the church, I mean all of us, mm-hmm. Myself included, have made this topic too simplistic,
right?
Where we've started with the theology and this personal side is helpful. And so in our next segment, I'd love to continue the conversation about what does it look like to actually be proactive for the church, all of us as the church, to be proactive and to care and to love for LGBTQ friends well, where it actually moves beyond just speaking about the truths that we believe and to actually saying, hey, how can we show love to maybe move the needle from that 80% of people within the church that think it's anti-homosexual? So let's continue that conversation after a quick break.
We're back. We finished the last segment just talking about kind of the experience of those who might be same-sex attracted but are nevertheless going to choose a path of celibacy, and how that is that's a tough choice to make. And the folks that I have talked to that would agree with a more traditional stance of marriage then have to grapple with some pretty profound things in their personal life. And oftentimes it's not about the sex. It's about, I don't want to be alone for the rest of my life. Or I don't, you know, it's like those types of things. Or saying they still have intimacy needs and they have connection needs. And it's pretty clear that the church could do a much better job. Or, you know, it'd be good if, you know, going back decades or whatever, there were different ways that we could talk about friendship or different way or something, you know, to give people that are same-sex attracted and want to pursue that path of celibacy to give them a little bit more hope. And I know that's something, Paul, I know that you have sort of talked about, and I would just love to sort of move the conversation that way. And so that just to kind of talk about what could the church do better mm-hmm. to kind of come around those who are same-sex attracted in a way where this could, where local church communities could be a place where they can flourish?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think if I could only say one thing on that whole point, I would say we need to do a better job of providing community and providing that type of intimacy that they're not going to receive from a spouse.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, that emotional connection and that physical touch, those are needs that every person has. And they, I think in our culture, we can get so wrapped up and so afraid of the words intimacy because of how it's portrayed in culture mm-hmm. That we can lose sight of the fact that intimacy is not synonymous with erotic touch or
right.
sexual touch. It's not. Mm-hmm. It can be, but right. it doesn't mean it has to be. And for those who aren't able to get that type of intimacy, You know, you think of the love languages, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then they need to get those from somewhere else. Everybody has their love languages, and they have needs. And if they can't find that somewhere, then it's going to be really hard to sustain a life without that.
Right.
I mean, as you think of people that might be listening to this podcast that are in similar shoes as you, where they're like, I want to follow Jesus, I'm considering, or maybe they've are living into the step of celibacy and are struggling with it, where they would say, you know what, I am lonely right now. What would you tell them to find? Do we have something we can tell them to find encouragement, to find hope? I know you've been doing a lot of thinking around this, mm-hmm. and how the church can do a better job, mm-hmm. in providing community that fits those things. What would you say to somebody maybe that's in those shoes right now that is feeling lonely and is in the church?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if this would be the first answer that everyone would want to hear, but one of the things that the reasons that I think that God might not be helping orientation change happen is because there is a conversation in the church that needs to happen, mm-hmm. to show love to a people who are really hurting.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
And I think that being part of that conversation, or at least a catalyst to that conversation, is something that is very worthwhile spending time and putting hope into. I'm thinking of so many people who are just hurting and want nothing to do with the church, nothing to do with God, because how they hurt they've been in this conversation. And I find life putting my energy into helping that conversation happen in the church, so that the church can learn to be better at loving anybody, really, who is needing and hurting. So putting their energy into that, and really in the process of doing that, you're gaining friendships, mm-hmm. and you're making these bonds with the church. The church can slowly become your family, and that's really the goal of the whole conversation, really, anyway, is that you no longer are an outsider. You are being integrated into God's family and God's church, and you're developing those bonds. And as people get less and less afraid of intimacy, you're able to feel that love, really, that God speaks of when he talks about his church body as his family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like the idea that, I mean, that when we really truly start to think of ourselves as all in the same boat, which we're not with our unique journeys, but in many ways we are. And I love the idea that we are all, first of all, in our identity. If we've come to Christ, then our identity is found in God, but also the idea that we are still all broken. Mm-hmm. And so the more authentic that we all are with our stories, and the more open we are to hearing other people's brokenness and allowing people to enter into ours and being vulnerable, the more that the church actually can start to resemble a family. I've noticed that in any kind of group that I've been a part of, it's those groups that move past the either the hidden secrets, or even where the jokes or the things that can maybe push people away, and if they move to a place of vulnerability, mm-hmm. then that's where you start to see, I think, what God intended. And the only way that happens is if we're vulnerable, and if we're open to people being different, and that we show that the most when people are actually different from one another.
Mm-hmm. I think the reality here within our culture, within the Christian community, this issue has been set up as the ultimate sort of line in the sand, and like the theology thing. And if the church, you know, I think within a lot of segments of Christendom, there's a fear that if the church appears even to be open, or to, you know, have a crack in the armor, that we're just gonna, you know, everything's going to fall apart. We're going to lose marriage. We're going to, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And I think what you're talking about, Eric, is like, we don't have to approach this with so much fear.
Mm-hmm.
We can lead with love, and we can work through things together. And ultimately, you know, I think, Paul, this is going to kind of put you on the spot with a statistic question, but, you know, earlier you talked about kind of the percentage of folks within the sexual minority was 4 point something, and then 7 point something of millennials. What's the percentage? I've heard you give a stat before, and I'm going to call upon your memory. the percentage of homeless teenagers who are LGBTQ.
Yeah, 40%.
40%. Mm-hmm. So the amount of rejection that it's like, if the church is a part of that rejection, then we have gone a long way down the wrong road. Mm-hmm. Regardless of where, you know, sort of we stand on sexuality, it's like if we're not leading with love, if people feel that the church is not a safe place to go to learn about God's love for them, then we have some repenting to do. This is a tricky conversation within Christendom, but these are real people who've really been hurt, and I appreciate, you know, I appreciate your friendship, I appreciate your willingness to come and be open and to tell your story. I appreciate your heart and your love for individuals who are LGBT, but then also just your love for the church. So thank you.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
I would echo that too. That there's just not too many nuanced voices that can enter into this conversation, both with personal experience, but also clarity and the willingness to understand both sides of where everyone's coming from, both from people that are not same-sex attracted to those that are, but even to navigate the waters within the same-sex attracted community, and to do that with grace and openness and thought is a rare thing, and that's where we're just blessed to have you as a friend, but also for you to have the courage to share your voice with people that are listening, because I wish everyone had a Paul Martel in their life.
Right.
Not everyone does,
right.
And they should be jealous of the fact that we do, mm-hmm. But I wish that they did, because I think it would change the tenor of this conversation.
Right.
It may not change someone's theology ultimately.
Right.
There are some truths that are outside of ourselves that we need to, mm-hmm. we all need to grapple with, but it should change the tone. And
right.
the fact that there are 40% of gay teenagers that are mm-hmm. homeless, that just astounds me.
Right.
And that should make us angry.
Right.
You know?
It should. Well, thanks again, Paul, for being here. And we will, you know, in a future podcast, we're no doubt going to, there are some key scripture passages we're going to look at. There's some theological concepts we need to wrestle with, but we just wanted to start with a conversation. And so I'm going to ask your permission if we might call you again, you
yeah,
know, sometime
absolutely.
and have you be part of the conversation because you're our friend and we value your opinion. So thanks again for being here.
I'm grateful for you guys. Thanks so much.
Yep.
And we want to thank you for listening as well. And we hope that you found it helpful and that you'll continue to journey with us. And you can do that by going to our website, which is page2podcast.com. And there you can also let us know just what you're thinking and maybe leave a comment. We want to close with a special shout out to the Center for Church Renewal for letting us graciously use their recording space, for David Powers, who has given us a lot of technical expertise, and Reflect, our great friend. Reflect is spelled with a K, and he gave us the super cool music. Thanks for joining us today.